Hello, welcome to the Refereed Papers track. Our first speaker is Wes Featherston. He's from Atlanta, Georgia. He graduated from Wake Forest University in 2008 and this year received a master's degree. Wes is going to tell us about a very interesting use of logs. We think of logs as being something we react to, but he's going to tell us how to be proactive. Please welcome Wes.
Thanks, everyone. I'm happy to be here, and I'm glad you could join me for the talk about using syslog message sequences for predicting disk failures. To start with, just a few high-performance computing trends to be aware of. Right now, obviously, the easiest way to get more speed, more and or more storage is to add more processors and add more disks. For example, there's an IBM BlueJeans system at LL&L with over 200,000 processors. And as systems become larger and they have more components, just in total numbers, then it's also more likely that at any given time you're going to have at least one of those components that's either straight up failed or is operating in some sort of reduced state, which of course means you're going to spend more time with a lower overall system utilization. And for this project, we're just going to go ahead and assume failures are going to happen. You can't really prevent, well, maybe you can, but we're not worried about it. We're going to accept the fact that some failures are going to happen sometimes. But what we want to know is, can we mitigate those failures? For example, if you can predict a disk failure, could you have a smarter application scheduling? And of course, we need to be able to actually predict failure events. Otherwise, why bother talking about mitigating failures? And the two questions, well, I guess the big question we had was, is that even possible? And to begin to answer that question, we need some sort of system information, obviously. Now, pretty much every system maintains some sort of log file. The thing we chose, obviously, was syslog, because you get it with Unix, you get it with Linux, and we wanted to have a pretty generalizable approach. A syslog, of course, records pretty much, not any, but a majority of the changes in system state, like logins, perhaps a login success, a login failure, in our case, disk failures. And we'll just quickly go over one syslog message to get the important parts. Obviously, host is the system that posted the message. And we're not going to be too concerned about facility and level, but what we do care about is the tag message, or the tag number, I'm sorry. And what the tag number is essentially a numerical indicator of how important the message is. So a tag number of 0 is very critical. A tag number of 160 probably isn't that important. The time field, of course, is when the message was posted, and then message is some amount of clear text description of the event. And what we're trying to do is take these past events and see if we can predict future behavior from them. And of course, the event we chose was the disk failure. It's estimated that by 2018, large systems could have over 300 concurrent disk failures at a time. So it would be pretty useful if you could, predict those and maybe schedule applications differently, maybe have it go into a maintenance state early. And it's also a very easy event to identify in logs, which is useful. And our main goal, as you see here, we have both a depth and a lead time on the right side of that little graphic there. And what lead time is we wanted to provide some amount of time before the failure. Obviously, it's not useful if 2 minutes before a disk fails, a message pops up and says, hey, disk's about to fail. So what we want to do is have maybe 12 hours, maybe a day, maybe 2 days before the disk fails, so you actually have some sort of warning. And then the depth is the number of messages we need to analyze to actually be able to make a meaningful prediction. And if you have fewer messages you have to parse through, the entire process takes less time, so we want to minimize the depth as well. There's a little bit of previous work in the general field of failure predictions. Hamerly et al. Used a naive Bayesian classifier and got about 52% accuracy within 48 hours. And IBM actually had a really good disk prediction approach. I think it was closer to 89% accuracy, actually. But they use a very specific logging system for one of their BlueJean computers, and we wanted to use syslog so it's more universal. And Broadwell actually achieved 100% accuracy with a prediction method, but he only had 3 failures to start with, and his approach isn't scalable because he actually had to go through like handwritten documents, which isn't easily automated. And then Turnbull et al. Also used an approach that's pretty similar to ours, and but they did it on system board failures instead of disks. Now, the classifier we're going to use to try and predict disk failures is going to be a support vector machine, also known as an SVM. And it's a binary classifier, so you get 2 classes. Either it is a failure, it's not a failure, it's green or it's red. And each vector consists of features, so some sort of descriptor about what happened, and I'll show you a little later in a slide or two what features we used. And essentially how an SVM classifies is it tries to find a single plane that separates every single, or both classes, so all data points in one class fit on one side of the hyperplane and the other are on the other side of the plane. And it's not always possible to do in the input space, which is what the little graphic is supposed to be sort of a demonstration of. It's not necessarily always possible to separate them in input space, but you can then use a higher dimension input space, so you might have to go from 2 dimensions to 3 dimensions, for instance, or maybe 7 dimensions. It's you can always find some number of dimensions in which they'll be separable. You just have to figure out what that is. And it's called a support vector machine because once you look at all the data and analyze it, you only need to pay attention to a few of the vectors, not all of them. They would, for this example, the only vectors you actually need are the vectors that are along the dotted line, because those are the closest, green circle to the class of red crosses. So you only need to look at those green circles to see if it fits in the green circle class. And these are the features we used. Essentially, we leveraged spectrum kernel data, which is a way to look at not just messages in isolation, but in sequences. So it provides a little bit of context to each message. Instead of just seeing like it's a tag number of 3, you might see that it's surrounded by 2 other critical tag numbers, and maybe that's useful. And this is just kind of an example. We have 2 symbols that are A and B, and for this example, the sequence length is K equal to 2, and K is just sequence length. So K equals 2, you look at two letters at a time. And there are 2K possible sequences. It's a little misleading, actually, now that I think about it. It's not 2K, it's whatever your alphabet size is to the K. And in this case, since we only have 2 symbols, one is A and one is B, we have an alphabet size of 2. But if we had, say, A through D, then it would be 4 to the K symbols. And essentially, to create sequences, you just look at a sliding window. So if you start at M equals that string with a sequence length of 2, the first 2, or the first sequence would just be A and A, and then you move one letter over and take the next 2, so you have A and B, then B and A, and so forth. So how do we do this for syslog? Well, as I indicated earlier, each message has a tag number, and essentially we make sequences out of tag numbers. The biggest problem we ran into with the tag number section of our research was there are actually 190 possible tag numbers, but the SVMs, as you saw, the alphabet size is actually really important. So we wanted to reduce the alphabet size by quite a bit because it's easier to, rather than have, sequences of length 7 with 190, or an alphabet of 190, if you can get that down, you can make processing go a whole lot faster. So what we settled on was we grouped each tag number into one of three categories. It was a high criticality if the tag number was less than 10. Anywhere between and including 10 and 140 was a medium criticality. And then low criticality was anything above about 100, was exactly 140 tag number. And as I mentioned, we just used a sliding window. And I have an example here for you. So like before, we have a little string. And these are tag numbers. And then assume the alphabet size is 3, because we have criticalities of either 0, which is high, 1, which is medium, or 2, which is low criticality. And essentially, you use a sliding window on those. And you can get those sequences that you see in the third column. And then the actual sequence number is in the fourth column. And just to just in case you're not entirely convinced, you'll notice that the first two actual sequence numbers correspond both to sequences that are all twos, and they have the same sequence number. And then the final message has a different sequence, and therefore a different sequence number. So every time, like anytime you would run across a sequence of 2, 2, and 0, you would always come up with a 7. Anytime you have a 2, 2, 2, you come up with a 26. And there's actually an equation, which I think I forgot to mention. I'm sorry. There it is. And you get the sequence number by using the equation shown there. For our experiments, we got data from Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. They have a cluster there. It's a 1,024 node cluster, and we got about a little under 2 years of data, and they average about 3 messages per hour for each system. And we got about 125 disk failures. And as you can see, tag values were between 0 and 180. And we pretty much, how we came to the conclusion of using only 3 numbers for our criticality levels was that there are sort of 3 groupings in the overall tag distribution histogram. It seemed to make sense if we're trying to lower the number of total letters in our alphabet to kind of group things that are nearby. And so essentially what we did was use an SVM based on the number of times each tag appeared, as well as the number of times each sequence appeared. And of course, we had to figure out the optimal lead time, window size, and then also sequence length. And we used 3 metrics to try and measure how well we were doing. Accuracy is just the number of total right predictions you make, whereas precision is the number of predicted failures that actually occur. So if you have a high precision, pretty much all of the actual failures you predict happen. Whereas, if you have, a lower precision, you'll be predicting a whole bunch of events that don't happen, and that's probably not a good thing either. The final metric is recall, which is just out of every failure that happened, how many did we actually catch? So the two we're really focused on are precision and recall, because we both want to predict the failures, but we don't want to have too many false positives either. And turns out that the optimal lead time is about 100 messages, as you can see from the graph on the left. And the reason we think it works best at about 100. Sorry, I zoned out there for a second. The reason it works best at about 100 and gets worse as you have a higher lead time is that, disks work fine until they don't, essentially. So if you have a whole bunch of, you need to be able to catch that small window when they start not working, but they haven't actually failed yet, and that's at about 100 messages. Before then, you're missing all the actual error signs. By the same token, the optimal window size is about 800 messages, and you need to keep that sort of low as well, because if you have too many messages, then you have a whole bunch of messages that just report, hey, the disk is working fine. And sure, you might have one or two messages that indicate maybe it's not working, but they get lost in the noise of all the, hey, I'm working fine messages as well. And of course, you have to figure out whether or not the sequence length matters. You would think maybe a longer sequence length is always better, but that's actually not the case. The table shows that actually there are two lines I really want to point out. One's when sequence length is 5, the results are getting better up until then, and then again at 7. There's a little dip at 6, but let's not worry about that. The thing with SVMs is they take a while to train. And while the precision at 7 is actually significantly better than the precision at a sequence length of 5, it also takes that much longer to train. So what we found is that a good medium between results and training time is a sequence length of about 5. But this entire thing is sort of up to you and what you want to prioritize. If you really want fewer false positives and you're willing to eat that extra training time, 7's great. Go for 7. Now, just looking at tag messages, you have no idea how fast those tag messages come in. Maybe having a whole bunch come in within a minute of each other is important. Maybe it's not. So what we wanted to look at as well was what's the rate of messages for each sequence? So for each 5 or 6 or 7 message sequence, how many seconds did it take for all those messages to arrive? And we're thinking maybe this would help, maybe message rate would be important, but actually it makes the results worse. And I think that's mostly because just the actual arrival rate on our data is actually pretty consistent. So it looks just like, oh, this looks like all the other good disks. Nothing's weird. And it's just a whole bunch more data a whole bunch more noise that just masks all the actual warning signs. However, something we found out when we were trying to use some other data from PNNL is that tag numbers actually aren't always available, and they seem to kind of be on their way out, at least at the data we've looked at, which of course there's no point in creating a tag-based approach if no one uses tag messages. So instead, we tried to look at the actual message field itself. And the way we did that is really similar to the tag message approach. Essentially, what we did is created a dictionary of words, and at first, the idea was to use just any space-delineated string, but that's over 1 million unique strings we came up with, and that actually becomes impossible to classify on using SVM Lite, which is our classifier. So clearly we had to reduce that a bit. And essentially what we did to do that was we ran the SVM on that million, using only a sequence length of 1, so it's only how many times did each word appear, and we got 52 unique keywords, and we decided to go ahead and classify on that, because these are the things that SVM Lite thinks are important. But there was a little bit of overlap in the words it picked out, like similar words, like it might be, HPC7 and HPC6, well, those are essentially the same message. So we just collapsed down into about 24 categories of messages instead of 52 unique keywords. And essentially, you just go through the log, and you have your keyword dictionary, and you replace every word with a number. So each keyword gets its own unique number. And if the word you're looking at isn't in the keyword dictionary, you throw it away. You don't care about it. And then you use a sliding window of 2 or more words to create word sequences. It's very similar to the tag message. And as you'll see, much like the previous example, you have keywords and encodings, and sequences are shown to you in the third column, and then we use the exact same equation and get the sequence numbers. And I sort of touched on this briefly, but like I said, the 54 keyword dictionary has had more specific information, and one of the things that worried us was it had specific node names. And well, okay, if you're picking out node 12, maybe node 12 just fails a lot, and then it doesn't do any good if you're trying to apply this method to, say, node 34. So instead, we collapsed it all down into a 24 keyword dictionary, and where like all the node names were one number, so node 1, 2, 3, all were mapped to, say, 0. And the accuracy, precision, and recall are pretty similar. The precision actually dips a little, but the recall goes up, so it's a fair trade. And again, we have to look at the correct sequence length because we're still using the message or the window size and lead time as a 100 message lead time and 800 message window size. And to get back to what I said about training time, how a higher sequence can increase training time somewhat dramatically. Sequences of length 5, while doable, do take a while. Sequences of length 6 actually take prohibitively long to try and train on, which is why you don't see an entry for 6 there. And what we chose to work on was sequences of length 4 because they train very quickly and provide similar results to sequences of length 5. And so we decided to try timing information again, even though it didn't work with tags, because there's one key difference between the tag approach and the keyword approach. With the tag messages, for each syslog message, you get one tag message. But with the keyword approach, we throw out all the words that aren't meaningful. So it's possible that you could go through 7, 8 messages and not see a keyword. And timing information in this case, it's the difference between the first keyword in the sequence seen and the last keyword in the sequence seen. So you might have a difference of, say, 4 minutes. So that shows you that there actually was quite a difference between the arrivals of each of the messages. Or maybe the difference is 0. Maybe they were all in the same message. And that also is useful. As you can see, the precision actually increases a bit. But the recall dips, and it just seems to be, I mean, it's a bit of a trade-off, because do you want to catch more overall failures, or do you want it to be really sure that everything that fails will fail? And in general, from here on, you'll see if precision increases, recall tends to dip a little, because you're kind of working in the shades of gray between this may or may not be a failure, I'm not sure, and using one approach will tip it to be make sure it's extra sure, one approach will be willing to take a few more risks. And the final thing we did was, since both tags and keywords worked pretty well in isolation, we tried to combine them. And they work okay. If you don't have timing information for the combination features, you get nothing extra really. It actually performs worse, but your precision goes up quite considerably with combinations with time. Again, training time increases quite a bit. So would you rather have quick training or be extra sure that these are failures you're seeing? And conclusions, like I said, tags work without time, and 24 keyword dictionary works well with time. Depends on which, and those are high recall, and then high precision is combining tags, keywords, and timing information. And then we have a few areas for improvement. We only looked at SVMs. Maybe K-nearest neighbor or some other classification algorithm would work better. We have one data set. We want more, so we can see if this is actually usable for other people. And maybe this could be used on other failure events. And I'll be answering a few questions now, but if you have any other questions, feel free to email Dr. Fulp. He's actually still working on this project. I graduated, and I'm no longer at Wake Forest, so I'm not working on it anymore. But feel free to also email me if you have questions. But if you want to offer any sort of help, I would email Dr. Fulp. And that's it for the presentation part.
Now, as a beginning question, I'd like to ask you quickly, what's the difference between this approach and the naive approach of simply replacing the disk when it starts to show alerts? What is the advantage of doing this as opposed to just replacing it when it starts to show alerts? I guess I don't understand what criticality is on these things.
Okay, well, the idea is essentially we as people, when we're going through these, we don't look at the messages to see what they say, essentially. So theoretically, the idea is to make it as automated as possible. So the idea is instead of having to read the logs, you just kind of have this thing running in the background, and then it, you know, sees these sequences, and then it goes, hey, it looks like something's going to fail. So it's essentially to keep you from having to do that, I guess.
Other questions?
So was it Toby Oetker, Switzerland, Oetker and partner, was it more of a sort of mathematical mental exercise? Because disks, what do? They fail. They don't have many other options.
Right. Well, I would say it was a favor to the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory system administrators more than anything. They actually asked us to look into this, so they must have had some reason they wanted to be able to do this. I mean, especially because they just opened up a new, well, I guess at this point it's about a year old, a new cluster called Chinook that's significantly larger than just 1024. They wanted something that could help them out, essentially, from having to, I guess, do everything by hand, if that helps.
Okay.
Chris St. Pierre, Oak Ridge National Lab. I was wondering if I could get some more information about the syslog tag numbers that you mentioned. I did some Googling, and I really can find very little on them. So where are those coming from?
Yeah, it was a bit of a struggle to find that information the first time for me as well. It's actually the syslog packet has, let's see, there's two separate fields. It's the level, and I want to say
facility.
Yeah, facility and level, and what the packet does is it assigns numerical values, and it's essentially there's a mathematical equation that determines from those two numbers the tag number.
Thank you.
Razvan Musaloy from Google. So is this really running? I mean, trying to detect failures for a production system?
Oh, no, not right now. It's entirely under a research phase. I think that's something that Dr. Fulp would be interested in pursuing, but that was out of the scope of my work on the project, which just ended. So going forward, maybe, but not right now.
And one clarification. So you analyzed like all the syslog, no filtering at all? Or how does...
Correct. The only filtering we did was to make sure we separated so we knew for our purposes which files contained failures and which didn't. But other than that, everything that they gave us is there. We didn't look at it at all.
I see. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't filter it. Sorry.
Let's thank our speaker.